Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the podcast, an interview with Dr. Anthony Fauci, originally held yesterday off the air as part of an Alfred P. Sloan Foundation seminar to help WNYC do better health reporting. But he also gave us permission to air the interview, so here it is.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios.
It's Tuesday, June 23rd. So Anthony Fauci was born on Christmas Eve, 1940, in Brooklyn, not in Bethlehem, but he got educated in the city's Catholic school system, including the Jesuit-run Regis High School in Manhattan. He says he took a bus and three subway lines to get to high school every day. He went to a Jesuit college, too, Holy Cross, which I think is in Worcester, Mass. In one interview I read, he gave a lot of credit to Jesuit training in precision of thought and economy of expression for being able to communicate science to a lay audience as clearly as he does. For those of you from the neighborhood with very long memories, his parents owned the Fauci Pharmacy in Diker Heights. Oh, those Faucis. He is, of course, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a position he was appointed to during President Ronald Reagan's first term. He was awarded our nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, by President George W. Bush in 2008. Coincidentally or not, Dr. Ben Carson was given the same honor by President Bush in the same ceremony. So, Dr. Fauci, we are so honored that you would join us today for this to help us do a better job at reporting on health. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And did I get that right about your Jesuit training contributing to your ability to be a science communicator? And if so, can you elaborate a little more on that training or those principles?
Yeah, I mean, there are two or three aspects that are very characteristic of Jesuit training. One is service to others, which is something that, you know, permeates all of their philosophy about life. We're really meant to be serving community and serving others. The other is that they're very rigorous with regard to truth, science, and evidence, and that they feel and have trained us who are fortunate enough to be in that training, that if you really understand something and you're precise in your thinking and you understand the question you're addressing, you should be able to express it with a minimum number of words. And that's what they mean by precision of thought and economy of expression.
And you sometimes go on cable television anyway.
Yes.
When you see or hear coronavirus reporting in the major media, are there any main things you think journalists have tended to communicate well and any main things they have tended to communicate not so well?
Well, I think that when they get a story and they're interviewing, for example, a scientist like myself, I find that the media persons that I deal with, be they in radio, like an NPR, or on TV, when they're talking about a specific subject, they do a really good job. They're doing their homework before the interview, and they also ask the right follow-up questions. You can tell if somebody knows what they're talking about when you give an answer and they have a follow-up question that actually leads from what you just said rather than the talking points they have in front of them. That's a dead giveaway. And I think they do a really good job of that. The difficulty you get into when you start getting media who are clearly slanted in one political direction versus the other political direction, and then you start getting some politicization of what you're speaking about, which is not really helpful. And I think anybody who knows anything about what's going on today realize that we're in a very divisive state in our interactions with each other. That sometimes gets in the way of either the interpretation of or the inferences that you might make out of a discussion, depending on what channel you happen to be on.
And I think also sometimes journalism gets the facts right, but makes its biggest mistakes through omission. Omission of scientific uncertainties or omission of context, things like that. So I'm curious if there's any coronavirus story or angle that you wish the media would do that it hasn't done.
You know, I don't know if I could answer that directly, Brian, but the one thing that I find disturbing is that when you go in good faith to get a somewhat difficult concept across, something that's serious, that involves the lives and health of the people of our nation and the world, and you say something in there that not necessarily the person that's interviewing you or the persons that are writing about you, but what get clipped out of that is a sound bite. And although sound bites I know are important to the media, sometimes the sound bite completely distracts from what the content of what you're saying is. And, you know, being on the media so much now, given the situation I find myself in, it's really very disconcerting when you said something that's important and two or three words get pulled out that's directed at some other question that someone wants to make a point out. Not only does it mislead, but it actually takes away from the content of the important message that was the core of what you were talking about.
Yeah, so often people just want to portray you as in conflict with the president, I think, and a lot gets distorted through that lens, and I'm going to try to stick to the science here today, overwhelmingly. I want to look back a little, look at the present a little, and look at the future a little. The general public never thought about pandemics very much, but there are experts in your field who did before the coronavirus hit, and yet at the beginning, the CDC's initial test kit was faulty and gave unreliable results, as I understand it, through contamination or other problems, and the FDA at first prohibited private labs from distributing their own tests as alternatives. How crucial were those two things, in your opinion, to our failure to contain the virus like some other countries did, rather than have to mitigate it with stay-at-home orders?
You know, Brian, obviously, if things had gone very smoothly from the beginning, things could have been better. The ultimate extent of how much impact that had on what followed, because what followed was really an enormous surge of cases that were very, very difficult to contend with, particularly in places like the metropolitan area of New York City. But yes, I mean, when you have a misstep, be that misstep an accidental contamination of tests that slow down the distribution of valid and reproducible tests to the public health community with which the CDC is involved in, is obviously something that could interfere with a proper response. And the same thing with the idea that we ultimately got the private sector involved, as is necessary and important, but we didn't do that quickly enough. And I think anyone that looks at the facts has to realize that that unfortunately was the case.
At the beginning of the pandemic in the United States, it quickly became clear that the impact was disparate by race and class. A lot of that is who the long history of inequality in this country has left disproportionately in these service jobs that we now call essential, and who is living in dense housing, things like that. But are there things about the healthcare system for infectious diseases per se that made the disparities worse that the country could address?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, there are some so very positive aspects of our health delivery and our healthcare system, but there are some things that still are difficult, and that is the disparateness of accessibility to health care, to good health care. So there were so many factors that went into the disproportionate suffering that the African-American community has had to deal with during this outbreak. I mean, just from what you said, when you're dealing with the types of jobs that they put them at a greater risk of getting infected, when they do get infected, the lack of as good access to good health care as quickly as you possibly can is another factor against it. And then there's the decades and decades and decades old social determinants of health, which have the African-American community have a greater incidence and prevalence of the underlying conditions that make the outcome of an illness like COVID-19 much more serious in the African-American community. Things like hypertension, things like diabetes, things like obesity and lung disease and kidney disease, all of which are disproportionate. So, you know, when I look at that, I say to myself that we always get so-called, smacks in the face to get us to realize things. This is shining a bright light on these disparities that have existed so long. There are things we can do about it right now, making the resources for testing and better access to care so that you concentrate resources in the demographic group and the areas that have high concentrations of that demographic group right now as the outbreak is going on. And then you make a commitment that the future, we're going to look at the kinds of things that got us into this to begin with. So if there's anything that's positive that comes out of this, is a reassessment of what we can do about these disparities.
How much of that, how much of that, in your opinion, should be in the healthcare system itself? If we're trying to eliminate the kinds of structural racism outside the healthcare system that contribute to poverty, what about the healthcare system itself in terms of lessons for equity? Like, are you a fan of Medicare for all or other systems for equal access? Or how specific can you get on any of that?
Well, I can't get specific on it because there are so many pros and cons, and people are arguing in a very politically charged environment now about that. So I certainly don't want to weigh in on that. But I do think when we look at our healthcare system, we have to focus on the reality of the disparities and say, this needs to be addressed in whatever plan you ultimately decide or whatever modification of any existing plan. It's a reality. You can't run away from it. You can't run away from it. It's there. We've got to address it.
Another major and very deadly problem area has, of course, been nursing homes. And I'm curious about what you're looking for now to know things are going better in the new hotspots that are emerging, or what you're looking for as a sign that structurally we're still in trouble with nursing homes and other group facilities as any potential second wave hits.
Yeah, well, there are several things there, and this is something that we've dealt with specifically in great detail in the coronavirus task force, mostly through the kinds of things that CMS does, since they're generally responsible for that. And there are many things that could be done. For example, the infection control oversight has now gotten much, much stricter. You know, there are many, many, many nursing homes throughout the country in which there have been no infections. So just because you're a nursing home doesn't mean you're going to wind up getting an outbreak. It's how you have your staff and the actual structure and the standard operating procedures in nursing homes that have made certain nursing homes highly vulnerable. You got to fix that, and fix that fast. And you do that with strict regulations, or you don't wind up getting money. I mean, that's the way you've got to do that. Secondly, when you're in an area where there's a high vulnerability, you do things like test everybody there and then surveillance testing at different intervals. That could be every week, every other week. Another thing is that you don't want an outbreak to spread from one nursing home to another. So you got to figure out a way how to diminish people who are staff going from one nursing home to another because all you need is an infected staff, particularly one who doesn't even know they're infected, who is an asymptomatic carrier, can wreak a lot of havoc merely by innocently go from one place to another. So there's a lot of things that we can do right now and are doing, not what we can do, what are doing, about trying to protect the most vulnerable in the nursing homes.
Were you aware of the controversy over Governor Cuomo in New York and some others ordering hospitalized COVID patients who were well enough to be discharged to be sent to or returned to their nursing homes, even if they were still COVID positive? And do you think that was avoidable?
You know, I can't comment on that because I was not aware specifically of that. I hate to be commenting on something that I hadn't a chance to really carefully examine.
I guess the dilemma that could be posed again in new hotspots is, what if they get to the point of having recovering patients who came in from nursing homes but still COVID positive, and a need for their hospital beds as the hospitals are getting overcrowded? Is there a solution?
You know, I'm sure it can be worked out. You're throwing a hypothetical at me that I didn't even know what the background of it is. I'm gonna call a timeout on that one.
Okay. And still looking back, what about PPEs? If experts knew a pandemic of this magnitude was a possibility, why were we short of PPEs when other countries weren't?
Yeah. You know, that's a good question. I hope that doesn't ever happen again. One of the problems that is, you know, systemic regarding availability of just-in-time products is that what we have done, it's come back to bite us, is that a lot of the things that we would ultimately need in an emergency are manufactured someplace else. If you look at the fact that we had a scramble to get, you know, N95 masks and gowns and face shields and other types of masks from manufacturers outside the country became very, very difficult and was quite problematic. We've got that fixed now. And hopefully if we do get other waves, you know, we keep talking about a second wave, we're still in the first wave, we still have a lot of problems to go through, that we don't ever even come near running out of equipment. We never ran out of, example, ventilators, but the health system came perilously close in some places to being overrun. The other thing that I think people should realize is that, as you mentioned, I've been doing this for a long time. My first encounter with an outbreak was in the first of six presidents that I've been in my position under. That was Ronald Reagan during HIV. And we've had pandemic preparedness plans along the way. And you'd be surprised when you're in a situation where there's no real threat. There's a potential threat, but no real threat. How difficult it is to get well-meaning people, some of whom are now complaining why we didn't do it, who, when we try to get resources to put much, much more in the stockpile, well, do you really need that much? You know, we have other competing priorities right now. So it isn't all black and white, and it isn't all good and bad. It's a lot of gray zone there.
Another gray zone might be that, and this might also harken back to your HIV days, you tell me, but New York is a bit of a success story now, getting the rate of infection down as low as we have, but we have now entered phase two reopening, office buildings, in-store retail, barbershops. Can New York test and trace its way to actual containment now? Because I wonder sometimes if obtaining the contact tracing names and getting exposed people to really quarantine can actually work in our society. And I think there was already an article in the New York Times this weekend about people refusing to give up their contacts.
Okay, so Brian, you have a couple of questions intertwined in there. I'll try to unwind them, but they're good questions, all good questions. So first of all, let me comment about, you know, my beloved city of my birth, New York City. I think that on the one hand, you all got hit really badly in a way that wasn't your fault. You were the first of that wave of cases that swarmed into New York City from Europe. Everybody was looking at China, and it came in from Europe. Having suffered so greatly, I think your leadership, particularly Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, have done a really terrific job in getting it down very, very low, so that they did, and I've been in many conversations with Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, who clearly, when they got on the phone, wanted to do it right. There was no doubt, there was nothing motivating them other than the good, the health, the welfare of the citizens of New York State in general and New York City in particular. So they listened to the guidelines, you know, to the initial gateway to get into phase one, and then didn't go to phase one until they were able to, according to the guidelines, now preparing to go into phase two if they have not already done that. The thing I liked about that is that they listened to the guidelines, and as the governor has said, when there were those pictures of people who looked like they were, you know, throwing caution to the wind down in the East Village, said that if we don't do it right, we're not going to advance to the next phase. That was, I think, really a strong statement that other states should take a look at. Are you going to be able to do the identification, isolation, and contact tracing well? I think so. I hope so. But you bring up a good point, Brian. You know, there are so many good things about the independence and the entrepreneurship and the lack of being told what to do with the American spirit. It's something we all cherish. But sometimes it could work against it. And when people start talking about the success of South Korea or whatever Asian country compared to what's going on here, you got to remember that we are a very, very diverse country with regard to our, you know, demanding that we make choices at the local level versus at the central level. And in some respects, that's great, but in some respects, it's not good for when you want to get a uniform response to something.
Well, Dr. Fauci, thanks so much for your time consulting with us today. I think our reporting will be better for it. I'm a great admirer, and good luck helping to steer the country through the next phases of the pandemic.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.